The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
Hi, Brian here, the integrated dentist for UKHealthRadio.com. This show is going to be one of the most relevant shows that we've put on. And I've got a giant of the dental profession who I'll be having a conversation with, Professor Ian Chappell. Ian Chappell is head of the School of Dentistry at Birmingham, professor of periodontology and consultant in restorative dentistry. Ian has actually done over 250 papers, including 7 textbooks, and basically is regarded as one of the main resources that we have. And this is not just in the UK, but globally on dental research, which to me personally is totally relevant to what we can actually introduce and give to our patients in terms of improving not just their mouth health, but their dental health. Ian is very, very busy and has got all sorts of sort of what I'll call commitments. So I'm really absolutely delighted that we can actually spare some time to actually have an interview with him. And I'm sure you will find this very, very relieving. Now, also, when I spoke to a lot of my colleagues within dentistry, as well as the hygienists and dentistry, when I said, look, I have the privilege of speaking to Ian, they said, wow. And so, you know, what he'll be saying will not only be relevant to my listeners who may not be within the profession, but also those who actually are in the profession. Ian, can you start off by telling me, how did it all begin? You know, what created your interest in the research that you've done?
Well, morning, Brian, and thank you. That was very flattering and not really true, but anyhow. I was fortunate enough to study, we all have mentors, and I was fortunate enough to study under a mentor or a few mentors who introduced me to various aspects of both medicine and surgery and their relationship to dentistry. And I guess that's where I started to become very interested in really not just the teeth themselves, but actually the soft tissues of the mouth, the periodontal tissues, which are the gum tissues, the blood supply, the immune response, the bacteria and how those bacteria can affect our body in various different ways. And I guess the most important thing I learned was the more and more we learn, the more we realize how little we know. So somebody once said to me at a conference, we're at the end of the beginning of research into periodontal diseases. That was about 25 years ago. I think we're at the beginning of the beginning now. Or the beginning of the middle bit. So there are huge questions to ask, huge numbers of questions to ask, but sometimes quite dramatic findings that you come up with that can have a very simple implication for day-to-day life, and it's conveying those or translating those findings into simple messages that, that actually make a difference to patients. Because at the end of the day, you can do wonderful research in test tubes and on benches involving white blood cells and bacteria, but ultimately it's translating that into something that makes a difference to people that, that really matters.
I totally agree, and really this is why, for me, it's such a privilege to be speaking to you, because obviously all research has got relevance, but because of my interest in nutrition and the way it affects dental health, and from the research and the books I've written, you're my main man, in the sense that it's so relevant to what goes out there for the hopefully the well-being of our patients.
Yeah, and well, I mean, the nutrition area is an interesting one in that, you know, traditionally in dentistry, the training is about sugar intake and reducing refined sugar intake because of tooth decay, and obviously that's very important. But in the last 10 years, we've come to realise that actually sugar, particularly refined simple sugars, can actually drive inflammation in the body in general. And you get these inflammation spikes after you have meals. And so that becomes relevant to periodontal or gum health and gum disease in particular. And it then also becomes relevant because if we as oral health practitioners, which is a term I prefer to use these days because it's more holistic, and I think more representative of what we do, if we're in a position to counsel patients on reducing refined sugar intake, from the point of view of periodontal and gum health, then there are obviously spin-off benefits. And those spin-off benefits will relate to general health, reducing the risk of obesity, diabetes, type 2 diabetes in particular, etc. So, and I think the classic example is smoking cessation, and the fact that with a very, very simple message in dental practice that might only take a minute, sometimes even 30 seconds, you can reduce smoking habit, you can get quit rates of something like 6%. And if you spend a little bit more time with behavioural interventions, you can be up as high as 15, 16%. Now, you know, that might not sound high, but you translate that across the population, and that's a huge, huge impact. And in fact, this has been picked up by the World Health Organization. They have a relatively new division, which is the Chronic Non-Communicable Diseases Division. It's headed up by a physician called Doug Betcher, and he's so I do work with the European Federation of Periodontology, and we went to Geneva and had some meetings last year, and he was particularly interested and driven actually by the concept of dentists, hygienists, dental nurses, the whole oral health team getting involved in general health promotion for oral health, but where there was a spin-off for general health, because it's a different workforce. You know, we see patients when they're well. Doctors see patients when they're ill. So we're accessing a cohort of patients that helps us actually implement prevention. By the time many patients see their GPs, it's too late for prevention. You know, they have the problem, and it's about diagnosing it and then managing it. So we have a lot to offer, I think, Brian, in the general health field, even if it's just on the back of oral health.
Yes, I think where I would say that your huge contribution is that if I take my undergraduate training, none of the relevance of good oral health was brought out in a holistic way. And I think it speaks volumes that your educational program for both undergraduates and postgraduates is giving this type of information out, so that visiting the dentist isn't just about looking for holes in teeth.
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, that was the one thing that made me question the career I'd gone into, was this complete focus on drilling holes in teeth. And to be honest, it's partly a manifestation of the way that dentistry's been funded over many, many years. Essentially, it's a very old-fashioned repair model of healthcare where you fix things when they're broken and you only get paid by fixing things. That doesn't really encourage prevention, and it doesn't encourage having conversations, motivating patients, changing behavior. you know, if you can change a patient's behavior, they'll do the job for you. They will actually start to improve their own health, which empowers them. It's less paternalistic in its approach. It's really about the patient taking control. And it's a far, far more effective and rewarding environment to work in. And I think that's the big challenge. We've got to somehow find some way of encouraging a preventive approach and a risk-based approach, but at the same time, make sure that the oral healthcare team are not sort of switching off, that they're engaged and they're still doing the checks and they're still intervening when they need to intervene. There's a huge amount of disease out there that still needs treating, and there's going to be for a long time. It's just in specific groups of the population, as opposed to being as generalized as it was perhaps before. But I think the biggest message we have to get across, Brian, and this really is what links, I think, oral health to general health, is these common risk factors and taking a risk-based approach. You know, every individual is different. If you take periodontal disease or gum disease, for example, there's not one single cause of gum disease. It's not necessarily just the buildup of bacteria on the teeth. That's necessary for the disease to happen. But actually, you know, 10% of the population will never get it, even if they never brush their teeth. So they're resistant. So there are genetic factors. There's lifestyle factors, whether it be diet, whether it be oral hygiene practice, smoking, stress. There's a whole host of these lifestyle factors. And actually, the way they come together to cause disease in one person is very different to the way they come together to cause the same disease in another patient. So unless we're really risk assessing our patients and finding a little bit out about their lifestyles and the various other factors that influence their general health, then we're not going to be as successful in preventing the disease or in treating the disease in patient A versus patient B, because we take this sort of generic approach. It's how we used to be trained in dentistry 40 years ago. You'll remember it well. I mean, it was very technological. It was very technical and algorithmic almost. It was you do this because it works. Nobody really thought about the biology, and nobody really thought about the, about why it worked or why it didn't work in one patient.
Oh, I absolutely, totally, totally agree. And also, I even at my what should we say, vast years in practice, now take a totally different view when I interview my patients. And just as you were saying, I ask people questions such as how's things going, you know, how's work or what have you, and when they say, well, you know, it's been a difficult time, I've had some bereavements, I've had stress, this, that, and the other, I now relate it to the relevance that may be showing up if we're seeing a condition changing the mouth. And this is with regular patients who I believe we can provide that little bit of extra insight into helping them get over often periods which could be stressful, which is having a compromise on their whole mouth system. So I totally agree with what you're saying about the fact that we've got to take a holistic approach, but also treat everybody as an individual.
Yeah, I mean, you're music to my ears, because I'm afraid not everybody really thinks that way. But you're absolutely right. And I would include mental health in that as well. People often joke that we have a liaison psychiatrist here in the dental hospital in Birmingham who we keep very busy, because quite often when we're trying to manage patients and we have those conversations that you're talking about, you realize that this is somebody who does have genuinely a significant mental health problem that people have ignored, or they've not been listened to by other healthcare professionals. And it can take a long time to try and manage that. Sometimes you can manage it just by conversations, by trust, just by listening, and showing that actually it is important and you recognize it's an issue for them, and it is potentially having an impact on the health. Sometimes that's enough. Sometimes you have to go to the next stage and refer for support. And sometimes you do actually have to refer for formal psychiatric assessment. And I can honestly say that in my 30-odd years of practice, I've never had a patient that I've taken down that route who has not, at the end of it, said, I really appreciate it, or thanks for doing that. I've never had somebody, you get an initial response that may indicate that, what are you insinuating here? But if you explain it carefully and you give the context, then you see the penny drop and they think, well, I'll give it a go. Make the referral. And to me, actually, they're the most rewarding cases, because these are people with serious, serious issues that have been off the radar. It's impacting on their quality of life. It's impacting on their everything they do day to day. And we're not particularly well trained, I don't think, in dentistry for managing those types of things historically. Far, far better now. The behavioural sciences and the psychology training that is now embedded in the programmes that I must admit, I used to think, oh, load of tosh. Actually is hugely valuable, probably one of the most valuable parts of the programs that we have today, because at the end of the day you can generally train most people to drill around hole in a surface. It takes some people longer than others, but actually thinking around a particular subject, thinking around a particular symptom or sign and trying to problem solve it requires a heck of a lot more insight and a heck of a lot more experience, and that's difficult. Difficult to train.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, this is why I have so much admiration for you, Ian, because I was frustrated by often the classic situation where you're seeing a patient, and I'm going back many years ago, who was keen, willing, would see the hygienist every 3 months if necessary, and yet we didn't seem to be making any progress. And until you go to the extra layers that you've been discussing, you would not often see a result. Admittedly, a lot of patients, if they see the hygienist regularly or the periodontist and they actually do what they're told, we see remarkable improvements. But also, there's those which we seem to sort of think, well, you've got to go that extra mile to actually get what I would call the result, which, as you rightly say, is so rewarding, because the patient thinks that, well, it's not just going to somebody who's just checking my teeth out and making sure everything's okay. It's actually providing a counselling service, but also you develop relationships where people actually believe that you are providing, yes, call it a holistic service, but something where to me, it gives me great pride, just like your good self, when you actually see a patient whose overall well-being we've had an influence on.
Absolutely. And it's not every patient. It might only be one a week, but actually it's worth spending the extra time on that one patient that week, because the impact you can have on their quality of life and sometimes on their quantity of life as well, actually, it can be really quite substantial. I mean, for me, the classic team member for that was always the hygienist, because they're brilliantly trained educators and listeners and motivators. And that's not something that dental students have been traditionally particularly well trained in. As I say, they are better trained now.
I've always used the expression that the mouth is a barometer of health for the whole body. And I've noted very much so that you have the scientific global, research to back up that the health of the mouth has got such a relevance to overall health. And in fact, we get the reverse, where the health of the body can often be reflected in the mouth. And I'm thinking of things like under stress, salivary flow changes, which then has a dynamic on how well our mouth is protected. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could just discuss things like the relevance of very common diseases, such as, say, diabetes, and how there is a relevance to the mouth health of the mouth.
Sure. So generally, when you look at these relationships, you have to go through different stages, and the fourth stage is the most challenging one. The first stage is just showing that there is a relationship, that disease A is related to disease B, independently of anything else. So with the diabetes story, we've known for decades, actually, that diabetes patients who are undiagnosed or who have poor diabetes control, for example, they tend to suffer from far more severe periodontal disease. And the reason for that is part of it's behavior, because behavior change is one of the issues for diabetes patients in reducing sugar intake, exercising more, perhaps losing weight, etc. And so they may have similar poor behaviors when it comes to their oral health, and we can't ignore that. But also there are biological links between the two. So, you know, if you have high sugar levels, whether you're not diabetic or you are diabetic, that glycemia or hyperglycemia, if you're a diabetes patient, it just fires inflammation off in your body in general at a very low level. So if you have an inflammatory disease like periodontal disease and inflammatory gum disease, then it makes it worse, a lot worse. And your white blood cells don't work as effectively. And so you end up with a gum disease or periodontal disease that tends to present more with pus formation and abscess formation than it would in a patient with better sugar control or a non-diabetic patient. So we've known about that for a long time. And actually that gives the oral healthcare team, if you like, a shoe-in to picking up undiagnosed or poorly controlled diabetes cases. But the reverse is true as well, in that when you have periodontal disease, particularly if you have severe periodontal disease, your risk of having of developing type 2 diabetes is significantly increased. And if you have diabetes, then your glycemic control, as it's called, your sugar control, is significantly worse if you have severe periodontal disease. And perhaps more importantly, the complications of diabetes, so the cardiovascular complications, the kidney complications, they are also significantly worse if you have severe periodontal disease, as is your mortality. Severe gum disease is associated with premature mortality as well, but because of these sort of common links and common pathways. So, you know, you can show those associations on big populations. What you then need to do is say, well, does it make sense? Is there a plausible biological reason why these two conditions may be related? And you know, the sugar I've explained is one example of one of those biological rationales for why they may be associated. And then you need to, perhaps the hardest stage is you need to ask the question, well, is periodontal disease one of those causal factors of diabetes? Is it one of those components, like at the beginning when we talked about gum disease and every patient having different contributing factors? Is periodontal disease in some patients contributing to the development of the diabetes? And there's emerging evidence now from the international literature and various international workshops, particularly one between Europe and America in 2012, that yes, there are studies showing that you are far more likely to develop type 2 diabetes if you have severe periodontal disease. And then I guess the final one is, the question as to why that may be is quite straightforward, in that one of the biggest triggers for type 2 diabetes is general background inflammation in the body and its effect on the beta cells in the pancreas. And obviously, we now know that patients with severe periodontal disease, if you measure the inflammation in their bloodstream and in the body in general, it's very subtly but significantly increased. And it might be a low level of increase, but over decades, which many patients have had the disease for, then that cumulative effect, that cumulative burden, can become really quite significant. And then the final point, really, which is, I guess, what's most relevant to us as oral healthcare professionals, is if we treat periodontal disease, can we improve diabetes control? Can we reduce the complications of diabetes and therefore have a genuine impact on that patient's well-being and general health? And again, that all the systematic reviews that have been done, you need to be careful how you interpret them, and that's why we have these workshops, to do it properly. They all point in the same direction, that if you treat periodontal disease and you treat it well, and that's important, if the treatment works, then you can generally reduce the patient's HbA1c, their background sugar level. HbA1c is glucose bound to the hemoglobin molecule. Red blood cells survive for about 3 months, so it gives you about a three-month measure of glucose control in a patient. It's quite a good medium-term measure. Those HbA1c levels can be reduced over a 6 month period by about 0.38 to 0.4%, which sounds tiny, but actually it's the equivalent of adding a second drug into a basic metformin diabetes regime. So, and if you speak to a diabetes patient, say, well, do you want to stick you on another drug or do you want us to treat your gum disease? I mean, we've asked that question. They all say, well, treat my gum disease. I don't really want to be on any more tablets. So that's a sort of a journey, if you like, through the science and what you have to try and do. And it takes decades to get to that point where you have sufficient knowledge to be able to say with reasonable confidence that, yes, severe gum disease is a significant risk factor for diabetes and its control and its onset. And the complications of diabetes. And if you can restore gum health, then you will improve the diabetes outcomes for that patient. And there's some data showing that if you've got somebody who's pre-diabetic and you can treat their periodontal disease, then you can potentially shift them into a non-diabetic state, because pre-diabetes is reversible. Well, diabetes can be reversible, type 2. But certainly pre-diabetes is very reversible if the lifestyle changes are made.
Yes, thank you. I noticed, Ian, as well, that you mentioned the word inflammation. And I believe that the general consensus in research medicine these days is that most of our disease processes is about the body being constantly inflamed. And I think this will be representative in cardiovascular disease. And many say that it's a very strong contributory factor to, and I say contributory factor in all these, as you know, there's multiple causes. But certainly, if there's a level of raised inflammation in the bloodstream, right the way through to, which I believe is even Alzheimer's, which a lot of the medical profession are calling type 3 diabetes. And therefore, I think, I know that you've done research into looking at periodontal health and inflammatory markers in the bloodstream, which isn't always just related to, frankly, sugar.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. I think it's important to make the point that inflammation, acute inflammation, is protective, and we need that to defend us against infections and trauma, etc. But the problem arises when the acute inflammation doesn't switch off or doesn't resolve. And resolution of this acute inflammation is a huge area at the moment of importance, because the body produces natural chemicals that will switch the acute inflammation off. So when it's not switched off and becomes chronic, then yes, that is believed to be the major cause of actually the majority of deaths in the developed world. Certainly, I mean, inflammation is a very important component of cancer as well. Not just heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, rheumatoid arthritis, etc., inflammatory lung disease. They're all inflammatory diseases, and they all have very similar pathways. And I think perhaps the biggest thing that we have to face over the next decade is getting to grips with something we call comorbidity. And comorbidity is where you have, you know, two or more of these inflammatory conditions. And if you like, the burden of having two or more than the sum of the parts. And, you know, if you look at the population, so we have an aging population, look at the population over the age of 60, 65, then something like 90% have at least one chronic inflammatory disease. And if you look at those with two or more, then you're close to 80%. And so that inflammatory burden has knock-on effects. So I think probably the best example would be rheumatoid arthritis. You know, why do people with rheumatoid arthritis not live as long as those without? And the answer is that a significant number die from cardiovascular complications. So the inflammation in the body in general from rheumatoid arthritis is huge. And that has an impact on the blood vessels, on the endothelium of the blood vessels, how well it works. We call it endothelial function. And also, as a result of that, on the development of atheroma, thickening of artery walls, rupture of atheromatous plaques, etc., that can lead to stroke, etc., or even cardiovascular events if the coronary arteries are involved. So they're all sort of interlinked and interrelated, and by taking one piece out of the jigsaw, you can actually start to have a positive impact. That was the wrong expression, really, a jigsaw you tried to build. But by taking one component out, you start to reduce the burden on the rest of the body, and other things can actually benefit as a result. And yes, I mean, if you take blood samples from patients and measure things like C-reactive protein. So C-reactive protein is produced by the liver and a number of other cells as well, actually, but it's produced as a sort of an immediate response, and it sort of it indicates low-grade inflammation is happening in the body. It's a big risk factor for heart disease, for example. If you measure C-reactive protein levels in patients with severe periodontal disease, the majority of studies show that they're significantly increased, just at a low level, but they are significantly increased. There are various other markers in the bloodstream you can measure of inflammation that show similar types of outcomes. If you measure fibrinogen levels, for example, blood clotting tendency, that has also been shown to be significantly increased in patients with severe periodontal disease. So question is why, and does it make sense? And when I try to explain this to medical practitioners who don't really get a great deal of time to study the mouth, they're dealing with the rest of the body, I think the best way of describing it is that we have 28 or sometimes 32 teeth, and these teeth are connective tissue structures. You know, they're in the bone. The dentine is a connective tissue structure, and they're sticking out through the skin. So you've effectively got 28 or 32 little bones sticking out through your skin. You know, if you had that on your arm or on your leg, you'd end up with some pretty severe infections. You'd probably end up with gangrene, and you'd probably end up with losing your limb. And so when we fracture a limb or whatever, a compound fracture where the bone's sticking through the skin, through the dermis, then we reduce it and stitch it over and cover it to protect the internal structures of the body. Well, of course, the mouth, those internal structures are constantly exposed as part of day-to-day life. And if you have periodontal disease and you have these little micro ulcers develop underneath the gum, underneath the gingiva, then the blood comes out when you brush your teeth and you get blood in your saliva. Bleeding gums is not normal. How many people have bleeding gums and think, oh, it's just normal, I've brushed them too hard? No, it's not normal, it shouldn't happen, even if you do brush them hard. But of course, it's a doorway, it's a swinging door, a rotating door. The bacteria can get into the bloodstream. And when the bacteria get into the bloodstream, they can travel through the bloodstream, and they can start causing problems elsewhere in the body. They can fire off the white blood cells, which can then damage the blood vessels, and they can cause all kinds of problems elsewhere in the body. So you've got this constant entry of bacteria into the bloodstream if you have severe gum disease, and it's fairly short-lived. The immune system clears them fairly quickly, but the next time you eat, or the next time you brush your teeth, or the next time you clench your teeth together, you're pumping those bugs into the bloodstream. And the more severe the periodontal disease, the bigger that bacteremia, the more bugs you're getting in, and the greater the complications. So, and that's the current thinking, is it may not necessarily be the bacteria causing infection. This sort of focal infection theory from Miller many, many decades ago is not something that we believe today is that relevant. It's more the bacteria getting into the bloodstream and firing off the immune system, or triggering a response, kind of an occult response somewhere else in the body, whether it be in the joints or the fingers with arthritis, or whether it be in the blood vessels of the heart, or whether it be the pancreas and the beta cells, and you know, there are, or even in the lungs potentially. So that there are, or the brain, blood-brain barrier. Those bugs can have been shown to get across the blood-brain barrier. And as you'll know, we're starting to see evidence for severe periodontal disease being linked to neurodegenerative problems and Alzheimer's, etc. So, again, it goes back to that one word, inflammation. And if you've got something in the mouth that is causing inflammation in the body, well, treat it, because you can reduce the inflammation in the body. That has to be a good thing.
Ian, I love the analogy about teeth or bits of bone sticking out through your skin. I think that is such a graphic picture that I think most of our listeners will actually really be able to understand the dynamics in the mouth. But what you were talking about was, in fact, obviously direct entry of toxins and bacteria into the bloodstream. But I believe that in a relatively poor mouth, that you're also looking at the microbiome in the mouth having effect by us producing so many bacteria. And if the, I should say microbes, because we're looking at viruses, yeast, etc. But the fact is that what is actually then going into our guts, where it is so important for our immune system and what have you, is that we're looking at a situation where, I suppose, if we have disease in the mouth, we also have the ecology of the microbiome has been altered in a more pathogenic way.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a really interesting area. You know, microbiology, it sort of is the be-all and end-all, and then it disappears and becomes not important, and then it comes back again in a different guise. And we're back with the microbiome and the recognition now, and there's very good evidence for this, that actually we need bugs. We know we need a healthy gut microbiome to be able to absorb foods, and it can impact on actually on a whole host of biological pathways. The mouth, the oral microbiome, is the second most complex in the body after the gut. It's hugely complicated. Something like 900 different species of bugs that are there. And actually what we need is we need a healthy microbiome for oral health, for mouth health in general. A sterile mouth would be damaging. But having the right bugs there is beneficial because it's triggering the immune system a little bit, keeping it alert. The immune system responds in a sort of a proportionate way and says, I know you're there, I'm keeping an eye on you, but at the moment you're not causing me too many problems. Problem is, if we allow those bugs to accumulate and some of those pathogenic species then start to appear. So one of the most important pathogens in the human body in general is this bacteria P. gingivalis that is associated with severe periodontal disease. It actually needs iron to survive and to thrive. And where does it get the iron from? Well, it gets it when you get inflammation in the gums and they start bleeding. So it might not be the trigger point. It sort of comes along later and says, oh, thanks, there's a bit of blood here. I can start multiplying. I can thrive in this environment and then cause other problems. And so you start to see a shift from health to disease and the microbiome shifts. And the term dysbiosis is being used to describe that. And actually what's happening is that those bacteria, the bad bugs, the pathogens, are actually feeding off the products of the immune response and the inflammatory response. So by the body reacting, then it allows those pathogenic bugs to start thriving. And you end up with this sort of downward spiral where the immune system's feeding the bugs are subverting the immune system, it's not working as well, causing more damage, which is encouraging more bugs because it's creating more foods for those bugs to survive. So it's a really, really complicated dynamic in that you could argue that something like gingivitis actually makes the plaque build up more. And it does. That's been proven. And everybody thought, well, it's the bugs that cause the gingivitis. It's actually both. The bugs cause the gingivitis, but the gingivitis fuels the bugs. And so it's really about trying to restore healthy bugs, and the simplest way of doing that is by brushing your teeth and doing it properly. You know, one of my patients yesterday said to me, you know, I'm 60 years of age and I've been through one course of treatment and all of a sudden I feel like a different person. Well, the reason they were feeling like a different person was they'd actually adhered to the treatment and they were spending probably 5-6 minutes every morning and every evening with a very dedicated oral hygiene regime. They'd taken responsibility and they were self-treating. And of course it works. But to get to, I don't know, 60 years of age and realize that you're not being shown how to clean your teeth properly from the point of view of periodontal health, as opposed to tooth decay, it's quite a sad state of affairs, I think, and a sad reflection on us as a profession if we haven't got that message across. As you get older, risk factors change, susceptibility changes, you're more likely to get periodontal disease as you get older, and actually your cleaning regime needs to change completely. you need to start using little brushes between the teeth as opposed to dental floss, which most people can't use and doesn't appear to be as effective as we thought it was. So you need to do things differently, and if you don't have that regular contact with the dental profession, you're not being seen on a regular basis, you're not being accompanied through life's journey, then those trigger points and touch points, if you like, for making those changes tend to be missed. I wandered a bit away from your question there.
No, not at all. No. In fact, the thing is that I think that you've actually completed the circle, because what you've actually described is exactly, in a very, very succinct way, what a lot of people do not understand about the importance of the health of the mouth. And what you're really saying at the end there is about looking at prevention, and the earlier we can start with this. But I think what you're providing, if I may say, is the scientific evidence so that people like myself can go out there, talk to our patients with the surety that you've done, together with your colleagues, especially on a global basis, the sort of groundwork to say that what we're telling you is actually relevant and in terms of what the public will call scientifically proved, or we're on the way to proving more things, which in fact we can deliver a message where it's, I won't say irrefutable, but we're at least giving people the relevance, and you're actually helping us by backing those things up.
Absolutely, and it is changing, and dentistry is changing massively, and I don't think it'll be too long before we see a situation where patients go and see a dentist, and we're doing a study at the moment on this, looking at testing for chronic diseases of aging, chronic non-communicable diseases in dental practice. Because do you know what? We ask the questions that the GPs ask, but we're asking the patients who are apparently well at the time and not diagnosed. So we're in a position to pick things up earlier just because of the nature of the patients we access. And I can see in the not too distant future a situation where the receptionist asks some questions, or the dental nurse, patient fills in a bit of data on an iPad, dentist looks at it and says, oh, well, this patient's at risk of diabetes, and offers a finger prick test there and then in the dental surgery. And if it comes back positive, then they communicate with the GP, send the results off, and all of a sudden the patient's in the system early. They might be diagnosed earlier, managed earlier, fewer complications. The whole healthcare economy starts to benefit from that. There's a really fascinating study published a couple of years ago from the States that looked at the financial benefits of treating periodontal disease for patients who had had a stroke, who had diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And it demonstrated savings of something like 40%, I think it was, in the case of stroke patients and diabetes patients, in their medical costs. Amazing. Their annual medical costs reduced by 40% just by having the periodontal disease treated. Really quite carefully run study, misinterpreted study, misunderstood study. When you look at it in detail, very well controlled, and those where the gum disease was treated, and it was treated well and properly, the savings in the general healthcare costs were huge. And so, you know, I think that sums it up, really. We have to start working far, far more closely with our medical colleagues. I say that, I mean, I always have in a hospital environment. It's never been an issue for me, but it's a huge issue in general practice, because you're divorced from the patient's physician physically in a different building, and there are barriers to referrals. GPs are swamped with referrals. And if we can take some of the screening burden off them, pharmacists are doing the same, actually, and start getting more integrated with those care pathways. Ultimately, it has to benefit the patient and the economy, the healthcare economy. We have to change. I mean, we can't continue with a health service that's coughing up so much at the moment in treating disease. We have to be preventing it more.
Absolutely. I couldn't concur. And even from my own experience that... you know, now I ask on a every patient basis of alcohol consumption.
And, yes.
Whereas, say, 25, 30 years ago, it was sort of almost socially unacceptable to ask these questions because we'd be seen to be interfering. But when you then explain the health implications of not just heavy drinking, but also regular drinking, then people actually start to say, well, actually, I'll take that on board. And again, it's a little bit of contribution towards an overall preventative strategy that being in the privileged position of seeing people on a regular basis, and as you rightly say, people who are seemingly well, and we can just hopefully steer them and keep them in that direction.
Yeah, and absolutely, and it's actually getting the context right for the patient as to why you're asking the questions. I'll never forget a particular patient who one of our students was treating. She was a publican, and I forget her alcohol intake, but it even made my hair stand on end. And I said to her, look, you know, do you not have problems with bruising? Well, a little bit. And I said, well, do you mind if we just check your liver function out and run a few tests, because it could impact on treatment we do. If your platelets are low because your liver's not working properly, or if we need to give you some drugs for managing something in the mouth, and those drugs are metabolized by liver, it could create too much of a strain. And her liver function was absolutely shot. Her platelet count was ridiculously low. I can tell you, she got to the end of a course of treatment, and we reviewed her after 3 months, and I wouldn't say she'd completely stopped drinking, but boy, oh boy, she reduced it dramatically, and her liver enzymes had come down and things were looking generally better. I think it had come as a shock to her. I think she was in a lifestyle habit, had no dramatic symptoms at that moment in time, didn't realise she was damaging her liver. And so asking that question about alcohol consumption was hugely important. It's only one patient, but you know what? Multiply that across the country, that's a lot of people we can impact upon, as you quite rightly say. So it's using the oral environment and the relevance of what we're doing, taking teeth out, scaling teeth. You know, patients bleed. If their liver function isn't good, they're going to bleed more, and it could be a serious bleed. So I think if we explained it in that context, most patients are quite comfortable, and they'll let you do the blood tests or refer them for the blood tests if you don't do them yourself. And you can pick things up early.
Ian, I think that for me, this has been an absolute privilege to hear your views. I have to say that, if I may, I'd like to call you the integrated professor. I think that you've been so succinct and clear that our readers would be absolutely love to come and see you if they possibly could, or certainly where you have an influence. I'd like to feel that a lot of what you're actively doing will actually ripple through the profession to provide that, what I'll call, extra service that we can provide for our patients. So again, I really thank you for your time and energy, and I wish you well for all the projects that you are doing, which I believe will have a manifest benefit to the population at large, including, to be honest, the dental profession. So again, I really appreciate your time to spend with me. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
I can see clearly.